celebration in Scranton, Pennsylvania. A lot of the cast had been to Scranton for various events in the past, but this was the first time that we would all be there at the same time. The citizens of Scranton were some of the warmest, most generous, most enthusiastic Americans I have ever met. Am I running for mayor of Scranton? Maybe I am. Then again, no, I'm not. I just want to point out how exceptionally nice everyone was. In addition to the parade, they threw us a party at the backyard alehouse. We had a Q&A panel at PNC Field, and the city organized an unbelievable outdoor concert in downtown Scranton. That Saturday happened to be pristine, breezy, sunny, and not a cloud in the sky. Perhaps most memorably, I asked the lady at Blow in Manhattan to add hair extensions after she blew out my hair on Friday morning, and my hair extensions remained perfectly intact until I returned to the city on Sunday afternoon. If that isn't the sign of a successful weekend, I'm not sure what is. Guest. In 2009, a dream of mine came true when I joined the cast of NBC's The Office. But I had barely settled into the lazy satisfaction of knowing that I was America's favorite sitcom's 18th favorite cast member before realizing that my dream job came with a toll. I would be expected to do publicity, which meant going on talk shows. Let me explain. Since high school, I have, and I need to say this carefully because I am now married, deeply admired David Letterman. Every weeknight, my sister Carrie and I would meet in the kitchen to eat ice cream and let this goofball genius and fellow Midwesterner shape our worldview. This crush wasn't complicated. Dave just made us laugh. Soon, I developed a habit of judging celebrities based wholly on their interactions with Dave. If he liked them, I became a fan. If he seemed unimpressed, I wrote them off. The worst crime, I learned, was being boring, and I shuddered on behalf of the young, chatterbox starlets whose stories went nowhere. With dread, I realized the same bar that I had set for celebrities on The Late Show with David Letterman would now apply to me. What if I turned out to be just another dull, chatterbox starlet on a talk show? My first major appearance was as the second guest on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno in May 2010. While I was relieved that I didn't have to face the king of my childhood kitchen just yet, I was still a nauseated wreck. In preparation for this essay, I forced myself to find a tape of the episode and watch it. It was like watching my own funeral. Actually, watching my own funeral would have been nicer, because I intend for that occasion to be a spirited celebration of my life, not a series of dry stories told in a poorly chosen dress that revealed more pale thigh than America should ever have to see. Jay asks me to tell him about myself. I report that I grew up in St. Louis, that I'm the only one of my siblings with red hair, and that, speaking of siblings, I have three of them. Pausing, I smile slightly and add, or I used to have three siblings. This hangs in the air for a moment, no one being exactly sure what I mean. I do not elaborate. It clearly sounds like something terrible has happened to my family. In fact, my two brothers and one sister couldn't be more alive. What I meant was that we all used to live in St. Louis, and therefore I used to have three siblings there. But I do not say any of this. Instead, I leave the audience only to guess at the horrors this strange redhead has seen. And why didn't she choose a longer dress? The saving grace of the interview is Gary Shandling. He was the lead guest, and throughout my segment, he chimes in and tries to help. At the time, I worried that he was making fun of me, but it's now clear to me that he's just trying to make the segment entertaining. At one point, seemingly 73 hours into my story of giving John Hamm a hug at an award show and getting makeup on his tuxedo, Gary compares that smeared tux to the Shroud of Turin. Neither Jay nor I react. That was an excellent reference, Gary mutters to himself. It was an excellent reference, and it breathed life into an otherwise lackluster piece. As Jacob Dylan, the musical guest, sang about how he had nothing but the whole wide world to gain, I wept softly in the darkness. If only I could have shared the cheery outlook of Bob Dylan's son. Instead, I was a failure, a boring, babbling starlet whom not even consummate talk show host and guest Gary Shandling could rescue. I received a flood of congratulatory emails after that awkward appearance. Family, friends, and coworkers all maintained that I had been very cheerful. A college friend complimented my posture. This is how people who love you let you know that something has not gone well. And yet, I now see this failure as a necessity. If I hadn't had the opportunity to sink the SS Leno that night, I never would have realized the amount of work that should go into making an entertaining talk show segment. Next time, I vowed to be better prepared. I made several more talk show appearances over the coming months, slightly improving each time. And when I was finally invited on Letterman in 2012, I was beside myself. I decided that I would feel more confident if I had something to show the audience rather than relying only on my stories, so I asked the segment producer if we could screen a home movie. A horror film titled The Man Under the Stairs that I had made 2 decades earlier with Carrie and, you guessed it, our neighbor Emily Sinclair. The segment producer agreed to put it in the lineup, but she could not guarantee that Dave would bring it up during our interview. Well, Dave did bring it up during our interview, and I nearly lost my mind. There I was, some overexcited fangirl with little business being there at all, sitting next to the man of my talk show dreams. I hardly remember walking out to the desk. I know only that I didn't trip. Looking into Dave's face felt like looking at Abe Lincoln. And believe me, I only mean that in the most exciting way. Dave and Abe are both tall, and they are both legends. And up until that point, they had both been figures I had only read about, seen reenacted, or watched on television. If I had died in the wings after that show, I wouldn't have cared at all. And not only because I would have been dead and therefore unable to care, I would have welcomed death because I would have just spent 5 minutes and 27 seconds talking to David Letterman, and I wasn't sure how my time on Earth could have gotten much better. Anyway, nobody died. And from a critic's standpoint, the appearance itself was just fine. Not amazing, but also not a disaster, which in my book was unthinkably wonderful because it garnered me the greatest prize I could have hoped for, 2 invitations to come back. By my 3rd time in February 2015, Letterman had announced his retirement. For my final appearance on his show, I wanted to do something memorable. And by that, I mean something that mostly only my family, my husband, and I remember. This idea rested in the pages of an old Hammacher Schlemmer catalog. I am voluntarily on the mailing list of this company of unexpected gifts, and I wouldn't have it any other way. Paging through it several weeks ahead of my spot, I saw a toaster that imprinted images of people's faces on the bread. I emailed my sister right away, asking if she thought this might be something I could bring on the show. "Order the toaster," she wrote back immediately. "Why the hell not?" But we weren't exactly sure what the point of the toaster would be. Should I tie it into his retirement? A toast to Dave? Now unemployed, he'll have more time for breakfast? Or was this a terrible idea? Was putting David Letterman's face on a piece of toast too creepy? Seized by a sudden decisiveness, I committed to moving forward with the toaster. Ellen from Burnt Impressions had toaster elements created, with Paul Shaver's face in one toaster slot, Dave's in the other, in 48 hours. The segment producer was on board, but as with my first appearance, there was no guarantee that Dave would get to the bit. After a few minutes of my famous B-plus banter with Dave, he said he understood that I had brought a gift. He plopped the toaster on his desk, and I inserted 2 slices of potato bread. As Paul played some light piano accompaniment, Dave and I watched the toaster for a good 2.5 minutes. That was precisely the idea, to waste several minutes of national airtime watching bread toast. Miraculously, when the toast popped out, you could make out Dave's and Paul's faces. Dave offered some jam and butter, and the 3 of us ate the most delicious meal of my life. I know it wasn't Christ's face on a piece of linen cloth, but it was Dave's face on potato bread. Thanks to bombing 5 years earlier, I got to experience a true moment of joy. I did a stupid bit with a comedy hero, and it wasn't boring. Or it was, but it was boring in a good way. American. I'm not sure if it was the glimmer of the big city lights or just the freshness of a new land, but I knew from the moment I stepped off the bus in Hannibal, Missouri, that I was meant to roam. "Look at the post office," I thought to myself, my fellow 6th graders clambering and yelling all around me. "And there's the highway, too." There was a post office and a highway, just like in my own hometown of St. Louis, Missouri, but I may as well have been in a different universe. Everything felt new again in this exotic place, and I was invigorated.
"When do we go to the caves?"
some adolescent klutz shouted next to me.
"Yeah, we want to see the caves,"
echoed his idiot sidekick. I rolled my eyes and smiled at the teachers. "Let's skip the caves," and go straight to the Mark Twain Boyhood Home and Museum, I mouthed to Mrs. Hoffman. After that, I would really enjoy an opportunity to check out the Mark Twain Memorial Lighthouse and Old Nipper Park, I kept mouthing. What? Mrs. Hoffman shouted. Ellie, are you gonna throw up? A couple of my carsick traveling companions were currently puking at a nearby McDonald's. No, I'm fine, I replied. I'm fine, Mrs. Hoffman. I shook my head and chuckled to myself. It's not that I was ashamed of the people I was with. It just felt funny to be the most sophisticated person there. As an American, I hold many things dear. Liberty, free speech, seems good enough to me, work ethic. But I also understand that the world is a big place, and big places require exploring. For this reason, I made a promise to myself after that trip to Hannibal to try to see just as much of our world as possible, and I have devised a list of pointers to guide me as I sally forth. Here are a few of them. Ellie's Rules of Travel. 1. Learn the language of the new land. 2. Adopt the customs and dress of the new land. 3. Do not sit still. Get out there! The new land is yours for the taking, and you can't take the new land if you are not walking everywhere and in constant pain. Blisters and blood prove that you actually did something. 4. Avoid tourist traps and attractions that might make your trip easy or fun. Nobody ever reached a deeper spiritual level by having a nice time. The first trip I took outside of the United States was to visit my dad's sister Julie and her husband, Michel, in France. Uncle Michel is a farmer, and the two of them lived with their 5 young children in a small village in Normandy. I was ecstatic. My grandpa would drive from Kansas City to St. Louis to stay a night at our house, and then he, my brother John, and I would all fly from St. Louis to Paris. My aunt would meet us at Charles de Gaulle Airport, and then we would drive the 2 hours to Le Mesnil-Moget in her farm-friendly vehicle. I was about to enter my freshman year of high school, and I had 2 years of middle school French under ma ceinture, my belt. My vocabulary was extensive and my verb tenses pristine. Furthermore, while I understood from Footloose that the only true universal language was dance, being able to make myself understood in a foreign language using words, in addition to dance moves, was a thrilling notion to me. In preparation for my trip, I went over my French textbooks exhaustively. I asked my mom if she wouldn't mind adding some omelettes or perhaps a pain perdu to the breakfast rotation. I felt sorry for my younger siblings, Carrie and Billy. While John and I would be off devouring La Lucerne Abbey and Mont-Saint-Michel, little Carrie and Billy would be stuck drawing imaginary towns on our driveway in pink and green sidewalk chalk. Au revoir, ma chérie, I whispered to Carrie as John, my grandpa, and I loaded into the minivan. Ta cœur et ma cœur. Your heart is my heart. This is not an expression used by people who speak French. I wasn't mad, exactly, to learn that my aunt's household spoke only English at home. My cousins were bilingual, so it made sense that the reason they knew English was from speaking it with their family. Nonetheless, I found the whole thing a tad tacky. We are in the heart of France, I mumbled to my brother one afternoon as we rode around in my uncle's tractor. It is really, really bad that we aren't speaking French here. My brother looked at me. Grandpa doesn't speak much French, so I think it's for his benefit, he said. I held my brother's gaze before turning my attention back to the tractor. And now, a visit to the cows, my Uncle Michel exclaimed from the driver's seat. C'est une bonne idée, I cried, desperate for the French to catch on. My brother rolled his eyes, and I began humming La Marseillaise loud enough for my uncle to hear. One afternoon, Aunt Julie asked for my help in the kitchen. Even at my relatively young age, I understood that preparing breakfast, lunch, and dinner for 5 children, Uncle Michel, Grandpa, John, and me, for 10 days straight, might be annoying. I was more than happy to help my aunt whenever I could, which, in this instance, was one time, that particular afternoon, for one dinner. To demonstrate both my respect and my humility, I knew that I needed to dress like an American chef in France might dress. One of those horizontal striped shirts that mimes wear, and blue jeans. I hadn't brought a horizontal striped shirt on my trip because I did not own one, so I asked my younger cousin, Emily, if I could borrow one of hers.
"Why do you need this shirt?" she asked me.
"I will be preparing the evening meal with your mama," I announced. "Somebody needs to feed the family," I added. Emily didn't have a horizontal striped shirt, but she did have a carrot-printed tank top that said, "Les carottes!" So I squeezed into it and headed to the kitchen. The tank top was tight. Emily was 8 years old. I was 14. But a shirt vaguely about cooking would give me the confidence I needed. When I appeared in the kitchen, my aunt laughed. "Did your laundry get mixed up with Laurent's?" she asked, referring to her infant son. All good travelers can take a joke, and so I chuckled along with her. "Now, what are we thinking for dinner, Aunt Julie?" I moved on. "A bouillabaisse? Et cook au vin?" I waited for Aunt Julie to be impressed by my familiarity with French dishes, but let's just say I'm still waiting. "I'm making meatloaf," Aunt Julie announced. "Can you just set the table and put some water out?" I nodded helplessly. Meatloaf? This was a dish I could have eaten at my own mom's house, and in a looser shirt, too. "What about the baguette?" I asked hopefully. "Does it need some slicing?" My aunt looked at me. "We finished the baguette at lunch," she replied. "There should be some Hungry Jack biscuits in the freezer if you want them," she offered up instead.
No matter. The road is life.
Kerouac was right. And in this case, meatloaf was for dinner. Many years later, I found myself not in France, but in another country, Austria. I had tagged along on a summer trip with my brother John and his friend Joey. The two of them had graduated from college the previous May, and I had just completed my sophomore year. We started our trip in London and visited Amsterdam, Paris, Berlin, and Munich before ending up in Salzburg. This city, which means Salt Fortress, was also where the greatest movie on earth was filmed, The Sound of Music. Accordingly, there was no shortage of bus tours offering fans the chance to visit its film locations up close. Now, I acknowledge that some listeners might interpret such a bus tour as a tourist trap or a fun attraction. These listeners might claim that such a tour would violate my rule number 4 of travel, avoid tourist traps. However, even though the bus might be populated with tourists, I knew that I myself was not merely a tourist. Quite the opposite. I was a cinephile who had never felt more at home. As previously discussed, I have loved The Sound of Music since the day it got stuck in my VHS recorder when I was 7. John and I used to perform the famous dining room scene in which Fräulein is late to dinner. He was the captain, I was Fräulein Maria, at family reunions. I even once tried to make a dress out of curtains! This movie lives deep within my soul. And to say no to a bus tour featuring its most glorious moments simply because it might be considered kitschy would have violated my rule number 5 of travel. 5. If you find yourself with the opportunity to go on a bus and drive around looking at statues and trees and a lake from the Sound of Music film set, grab it. I decided on a panorama tours tour. I even convinced John and Joey to join me. I had risen early that morning to make sure that my hair was washed and my outfit was clean. We had been living out of backpacks, because a Sound of Music bus tour demanded the most elegant version of myself. The three of us crowded into the back of a large white van along with 12 other people, and then we were off. And that is when everything went wrong. On the left, you can see Mirabel Gardens, our tour guide Jonathan shouted. Jonathan was from Kansas. I know this because it said so on his name tag. There was no microphone in the van, so Jonathan just yelled. He was also driving the van and couldn't turn around to face us. He just glanced at us occasionally in the rearview mirror. "This is where the song 16 Going on 17 was filmed," Jonathan cried. My jaw dropped open. Was he joking? 16 Going on 17 was filmed in a gazebo in a backyard. Do Re Mi was the song filmed at Mirabel Gardens. Should I say something? I looked helplessly at John. John was already asleep. I raised my hand.
I think it was Do-Re-Mi, I said meekly.
Jonathan didn't hear me. Or maybe he just didn't want to hear me.
I was quiet, but I was not blind.
Our next stop was Leopoldskron Lake. Anyone with even a passing familiarity of the Sound of Music knows that this lake is where Fräulein Maria and the kids stand up and wave to Captain Von Trapp before losing their balance and falling out of a boat. Some fans consider this to be the famous boating scene. Jonathan begged to differ. "Here is the lake that is featured during the song Do Re Mi," he screamed. I almost had to laugh.
So now you're interested in Do Re Mi, I thought to myself.
Suddenly you can't get enough. Fa so la ti, I continued, throwing in some of the additional lyrics to that song. I think this is the lake where the gang falls out of the boat, I said loudly to the rider behind me. Joey was now asleep too. The rider looked at me confused. Then she said something in another language, but I have no way of ever knowing what language it was. Here is the thing. This tour guide, this Jonathan from Kansas, was filling the van with false information. He couldn't get a single fact right, and he was reckless with the position of power that had been given to him. I felt that it was my obligation to right the course, to set the record straight. And then I remembered my sixth rule of travel. 6. When in Salzburg, do as the Salzburgians do. Even though Jonathan was from Kansas and not from Salzburg at all, I ultimately decided that all I could do was sit back and let the fake news fly. I should clarify, when not sitting in a van on a Sound of Music bus tour, all Americans should make a very focused and deliberate effort to distinguish fake news from real news. Here's Naumburg Abbey, where Fräulein Maria and Von Trapp got married. Here's Lake Wolfgang, where the famous boat scene was filmed. Here's the gazebo, where Mother Superior sings. To quote the Fräulein saying her bedtime prayers for the children, oh well, God bless what's his name. God bless you, Jonathan from Kansas. Several years ago, my husband and I went to Japan. Neither of us had ever been, and we found a good fare on Singapore Airlines. We flew to Tokyo, and from there would travel to Takayama, Kyoto, Nara, and Koyasan. Takayama was the city recommended by all three of the travel guidebooks I consulted in planning our trip, and so we were surprised when every Japanese person we mentioned it to looked back at us curiously. Takayama? They would repeat, confused. Hi, Takayama, Michael would say. Hi means yes in Japanese. Yes, no, and hello were all words that we had mastered several days before our trip. I was sure our confident grasp of three words would endear us to a nation. It wasn't until the train ride to Takayama, when we gave the train attendant our tickets, that we noticed there are different ways of pronouncing the city's name. How many stops until Takayama? I asked, being careful to speak very slowly and very loudly, so that the attendant would feel at ease. You are 4 stops from Takayama, he replied. I nodded and bowed slightly. I guess we've been saying it wrong, Michael said to me as the attendant made his way up the train. We've been putting the emphasis on the ya, but he emphasized the last 2 syllables with equal weight. I chuckled again. I knew that I had been saying it correctly, but I noticed for the first time that Michael had been saying it wrong. I guess so, I told him, patting his hand and smiling to myself. Kyoto was the city where I tore my plantar fascia. This ligament connects your heel bone to your toes, and it hurts a lot when you tear it. Because I considered any time not moving to be wasted time, Ellie's rule of travel number 3, I insisted on walking just as much as possible. This isn't Paris, I told Michael, hustling along the narrow shoulder of a busy highway from the Kyoto train station to our ryokan. Cars whizzed by us at incredible speed, and I had to shout over the noisy engines to be heard. You don't just sit out at the cafe watching the boulevard. I had purchased a pair of Superga sneakers for the trip. They looked to me to be really stylish, but they were also very rigid. Unfortunately, I hadn't broken them in beforehand, and my right foot had been aching since the moment I put them on. Our first morning in Kyoto, I rose at dawn and laced up my sneakers for a jog along the Kamo River. The concrete banks were filled with Kyotans, both young and old, some passed out, some not, some drinking, and some vomiting. I waved and called out to these new and fun-loving friends.
Konnichiwa, I cried, greeting the sun. And that's when I felt a shooting pain in my right foot. I fell to the ground, moaning in agony. An old man pointed at me and laughed. Something, 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 he yelled. I closed my eyes. I tried to clear my mind. I reminded myself that I am strong. USA, I said without moving my lips. USA! Standing back up, I embodied not only the strength of my great nation, but also its love of refined sugars. I smiled at the old man, beginning to hobble back to our ryokan. Seize the day, I yelled, falling again as my right ankle gave out. From Kyoto, we traveled to Nara, which is very famous for its free-roaming deer. It is also famous for Todaiji, an enormous Buddhist temple completed in the early 8th century. We had only allotted a day and a half for our stay in Nara, so I set my alarm for 6 o'clock a.m. the morning after we arrived. Todaiji opened at 7. As it happened, Michael would not be joining me at the temple. Our hotel rate included an unlimited breakfast buffet, and it did not open until 7:30. Are you sure you're okay to go alone? He asked me. I'm just worried I'll get dizzy if I don't eat. I couldn't have known at the time, but monitoring Michael's blood sugar would prove to be excellent training for taking care of my future infant son. I'll be fine, I told my husband, a grown-up man. I was the only person at the gates when they opened promptly at the stroke of 7. I marveled at the grounds and the architecture. In the main hall, there is an enormous statue of Buddha. It is 49 feet tall and weighs 551 tons. Big, I murmured to myself. Also housed in the main hall is Buddha's nostril, a small square hole in the base of one of the temple's wooden pillars. This hole is rumored to be the same size as the nostril in the nose of the great Buddha statue sitting nearby. I'm not sure why it's just a rumor. Seems like a straightforward measurement to confirm. Anyway, if you can squeeze your body through this hole, legend has it that you will be granted enlightenment in your next life. I figured that all the great monks before me had taken on this challenge. I knew that if I didn't at least attempt to fit through this hole, my visit would have been in vain. I thought of Michael, back at the hotel, soft-boiled eggs dribbling down his chin. I couldn't help but laugh and shake my head. While he was eating free breakfast items, I was out in the world actually living life. I looked up at Buddha, a coy smile dancing upon my lips. Like me, Buddha understood everything. There were only two other people in the main hall, and there were two security guards at the entrance. I put my purse on the ground next to the wooden pillar and took off my shoes. Then I entered the hole. I wasn't sure whether to stretch my arms out in front of me like I was attempting a dive, or to leave them at my sides like a penguin. So I did one of each. My right arm reached out ahead of me. My left arm clung to my left thigh. This was the wrong choice. I didn't have enough strength in my right arm to pull myself forward, and my left arm served no purpose but as a burden to be dragged painfully along the lacquered wood. My head was about halfway through the hole, my right arm grasping for the outside world. It occurred to me that I was not going to get any farther. My heart began to flutter as I realized my two fellow tourists would soon be rounding the corner and would see the American woman flailing. This shame scared me more than any idea of being permanently stuck in the hole. There is no greater punishment than shame, I recalled from either an old Buddhist text or something my high school indoor soccer coach said once. I coughed loudly, trying to catch the attention of the guards. If they could just get me out of here quickly, then we could resolve this whole thing in a snap. I could still hear them chatting nearby, so I coughed even louder. Still, no response. Hi! I called out, Konnichiwa! I cursed myself for not learning. I need help. Or even better, please pull me out of this nostril. I closed my eyes and thought of Bar Method, a core strengthening class that I used to take back home in Los Angeles. If ever there was a time to use that core, it was now. Embrace the shake, I said out loud to no one. That is something that the instructors say in Bar Method when your body begins to tremble because it is tired. Sweat is your fat crying, I whispered to the wood. I stopped feeling sorry for myself and began to embrace the shake, or, more accurately, I began to scoot backward out of the hole. This required an enormous amount of strength, a strength I didn't know I had, a strength that caused me to pass a loud rush of gas. It was hot that day, and I had chosen to wear a black cotton knee-length dress. The dress quickly scrunched up over my waist, exposing my Hot Bottoms brand pink briefs with stains dating back to 2002. Barefoot, farting, and overly exposed, I exited the hole the same way I had entered the world some 35 years earlier. What goes around comes around, I thought, wiping off my knees and straightening my hot bottoms. The couple had reached the pillar at that point, and I waved to them. Nice day for a crawl, I found myself saying. And that is exactly when I realized I had violated perhaps the greatest travel rule of all. Ellie's rule of travel number 7. 7. Always take the free breakfast. It turns out Michael had been right all along. But I didn't need to let him know that. When I got back to the hotel, I vaguely described my visit to the temple, mentioning the pillar and the hole and something about enlightenment, but not going into details. Michael handed me a carrot ginger muffin that he had smuggled back from the buffet to the hotel room for me and smiled. You should be excited for your next life, he exclaimed. I smiled back. I'm excited for this life, is what I should have said. This muffin tastes like fish, is what I did say. Bridesmaid. When I found out that I had booked the part of Becca in the 2011 comedy Bridesmaids, I chuckled quietly to myself and shook my head. Such wonderful news, I told my agents, trying my best to appear both surprised and humbled. I accept the role with honor. I was careful to pronounce the U in honor, and then I politely inquired after my agent's health. At the end of the conversation, I hung up the phone and smiled. The real Oscar, I thought as I glanced at myself in my magnifying mirror, should go to me for the performance on that phone call. The truth is, I was not at all surprised to learn that I had won the role. I was born to play Becca. I had already been a bridesmaid in real life 9 times, and taking my story to the silver screen seemed to me the most natural thing in the world. Furthermore, I was just emerging from a second season on The Office playing Erin Hannon, a woman marked by her naivete, her wide-eyed optimism, and her large face. One glance at the lone scene I had been given for our bridesmaids audition assured me that Becca, still don't know if she had a last name, was a creature not only in possession of, but positively defined by, her naivete, her wide-eyed optimism, and her large face. I determined that I could easily tweak the nuances of my performance to portray my face in a way that was still large, but large in a different way from Erin Hannon's face, and I swore to endow Becca with the dignity she deserved. As I poured my Epsom salts into the tub that evening, it dawned on me that I was poised to make cinematic history. There were 4 other bridesmaids in the movie, Wendy McClendon Covey, Rose Byrne, Melissa McCarthy, and Kristen Wiig, and the bride would be played by Maya Rudolph. I was familiar with the work of all these women, and I was excited to teach them about comedy. Kristen had written the movie with Annie Mumolo, and to welcome everyone to the cast, these 2 ladies hosted a night at Hollywood Men, a strip club near the intersection of Hollywood and Highland in Los Angeles. Having been a bridesmaid so many times before, I was no stranger to a male strip club. Did you bring your fivers? I murmured to Kristen Wiig, using my nickname for a $5 bill. Kristen laughed and told me how grossed out she felt being in this sticky nightclub. I looked at her and nodded. You'll get used to it, I assured her, placing a fiver in a passing stripper's underpants. I'm a waiter, he told me. Get your hands off me. I gave Kristen a wink. Sometimes I mix up waiters with strippers, I tried to convey in that wink. Here is the thing about being a bridesmaid. It is hard. It is work. And even though the bride is obviously one of your closest friends, you can't help but to start feeling a little cranky. I needed the plight of the bridesmaid to come through in Bridesmaids, and I needed to do it with as little effort as possible since I hate doing any work after dinner. As a bridesmaid in real life, I've been asked to do some pretty crazy things. I've been asked to buy plane tickets to fly to Las Vegas and Bermuda, I've been asked to purchase ugly dresses in colors that groan against my skin tone, which has been described as alabaster or bright white. I have been told to hike to peaks of hills in 100-degree weather to smile in photos where I am not happy, and I have been commanded to bustle a gown, soon to be locked up in a closet for 75 years. And as a bridesmaid in real life, I have smiled graciously, I have bowed before my brides, and I have written back, yay, 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 to things about which I feel anything but yay, 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 yay. Because this, listener, this is the plight of the bridesmaid. After our first official table read at the Sony lot, I began to relax. I think this cast has something, I mused to myself with a smile as I drove home in my charcoal Ford Fusion. They might just have what it takes. For the first few days, we spent time improvising scenes and getting to know one another. There were several different versions of script circulating, and I still wasn't sure which one we were following. I just knew I had to give Becca all of Ellie, except after approximately 5:30 p.m., which is when my energy begins to fade. One day at lunch, I sat next to Rose Byrne at the tables outside. Rose is Australian. I was making some light chit-chat about Australian accents versus British accents, and how they often sound the same to me. As I finished up asking her whether she felt more confident doing a British accent or an American accent, and if she had ever tried a Southern accent, as in Alabama or Mississippi, Rose Byrne removed her sunglasses. I was paralyzed. This is the most beautiful woman I've ever seen in my life, I thought. I had seen beauty before, but never this close, and never this deep. I could not move. I could not even blink. I forgot all about the other topics I had brainstormed over the weekend to have as backup conversation. Was Glenn Close scary on the set of Damages? Does Australia have presidents or is it a monarchy? Did she know I had seen only one movie in all of 2003 and it was I Capture the Castle? And just stared. My fork slipped out of my hands, but I was unable to pick it up. Rose asked me if I was feeling okay. I slapped my own face and said yes. Then I mumbled something about needing more water chestnuts, but ran straight past the salad bar and back to my trailer instead. I knew that I couldn't be in love with her, but I also wasn't sure that I was not in love with her. I did 50 push-ups on the floor plus 200 jumping jacks, and only then did I feel the blood begin to flow again to my brain. That woman is gorgeous. I realized in that moment that I could never, ever be in a scene alone with Rose Byrne. But that was not the only production hurdle standing in my way. Now, listen carefully. I had never considered myself a method actor before this film. In fact, I used to pride myself on my ability to keep my professional life and my personal life in two completely separate spheres. When I would finish a scene as Aaron answering the phone at the Dunder Mifflin reception desk, I left both the phone and the scene at the Dunder Mifflin reception desk. I do not bring my work home with me, and I do not invite my characters to spend the night in my head. And yet, you will notice that I have mentioned how many times I've been a bridesmaid in real life. The more careful listeners among you will see that this number is 9. But what none of you yet knows, and how could you, listener, for I have not yet told you, is that one of those 9 times was happening as we were filming Bridesmaids. Let me be perfectly clear. Not only was I playing a bridesmaid in a movie, but I was also being a bridesmaid in the real world. Life imitating art, you might observe. Observe again, listener, because it was life that came first in this case. I had been asked to serve as a bridesmaid in Scott Eckert and Vanessa Baker's wedding way, way before casting of the movie Bridesmaids had even begun. Art imitating life, you observe, without quite as much confidence. Yes, I tell you, grinning. Now you are getting it. Production on Bridesmaids began on May 29th, 2010. Scott and Vanessa were getting married on July 3rd, 2010. The 36 days that passed between the start of production and my friend's wedding day would prove to be some of the most trying of my life. Now, I'm no fool. I had read a Time magazine article once about what happened to the actors on the set of Apocalypse Now. I was familiar with the risk of taking a character too far, of pushing a production to its limits. I knew that extreme movie making could drive a person to the brink of insanity. And I would have thought that the experiences of Dennis Hopper and Larry Fishburne before he was yet Lawrence would be all the cautionary tale I needed. I would have thought Francis Ford Coppola's pouring in every nickel of personal wealth and still going over budget would have taught me to remain sensible. But I learned none of those lessons. Instead, I allowed myself to sink deeper and deeper into the madness. I almost allowed myself to disappear. I became Becca. Last name here. Ellie? Michael called out from my kitchen one Sunday afternoon in early June, a few days after filming had begun. I'm making tea. Do you want any? My then-boyfriend, now husband, had come over to my apartment to hang out. It was one of those rare, overcast days in Southern California that you normally only hear about in a song. I guess the clouds and the dreariness must have reminded Michael of our old days back in gritty New York City, or maybe there had simply been a tea sale at Ralph's. But whatever the reason, he found himself alone in the kitchen with a box of Bigelows, and he was asking if I wanted any. "Sure, Michael," I called back to him. I had already secured a position on the couch, cozy and warm under a faux fur throw that had come with the furnished rental. "I'd love some tea, sweetheart." I shook my head and blinked twice. I tried to speak again. "I'd love some tea, my sweetheart." I clucked my tongue to see if it was still working. I pinched my lips with my own hands. "Some tea would be lovely," I said slowly. "Sweetheart!" The words escaped from my mouth before I had time to catch them, and I clutched my heart in horror. What's so wrong with saying yes to some tea and calling your boyfriend sweetheart, you might be wondering. Listener, I will tell you what is wrong with it. 1, I despise tea. 2, I don't call anyone sweetheart. 3, I rarely, if ever, say, I love you. Consider that third detail a bonus, listener, and put it in the vault for later. Knowing me better than you did 3 paragraphs ago, you will now understand how completely crazy it was that I told my sweetheart I would love some tea. That simply isn't Ellie. That's not who Ellie is, and that's not who Ellie pretends to be. And yet it is exactly who Becca was ever meant to be. Michael joined me on the couch, a cup of tea in each hand. "Here's some peppermint for you," he said, handing me the mug. "Oh, boy," I exclaimed. "I love how it tastes like a candy cane." Michael looked at me curiously. He must have known something was happening to his Ellie, but I'm not sure any of us understood just what it was. "What do you want to watch?" he asked me slowly. "Oh, Michael," I chirped. "I just popped in the original Snow White. The first one, the one from 1937. Michael nodded and leaned back against a pillow. I reached for his hand to hold it, and I curled up into a tiny ball. "I love to be so cozy," I shrieked. "You hate holding hands," Michael pointed out. But it was too late. I was sipping a cup of tea, I was laughing at the 7 dwarfs, and I was snuggling with my loved one. Becca had taken over. I knew after that Sunday that something was happening to me. I could feel that it was a transformation not completely under my control. I didn't know who or what to blame, either. Was it the grueling production days? Usually maxing out at 9 hours, but sometimes up to 10, including a meal break. The demanding locations? Mostly daytime interiors, never more than a 25-minute drive from my apartment. A director who wouldn't take no for an answer? The inimitable Paul Feig, classy, kind, friend to cast and crew alike. The no he wouldn't take for an answer was to the question, could Paul Feig come to work every single day dressed impeccably yet somehow still sensibly in a dapper 3-piece suit? Maybe it was all of those things. Maybe it was none. It doesn't really matter anyway. A reason why wouldn't change the fact that I was slowly losing my mind. Madeline Wirth, Vanessa's maid of honor, sent an email in the middle of June. "Can't wait to see you ladies in a few short weeks," she signed off. I smiled brightly. "So excited for the big day," I began to type. "Let me know how I can help with any details, Madeline." I stared at the screen, reviewing what I had just written. When on earth had I learned how to use pink rose emojis? And, perhaps more alarmingly, Since when had I started offering to help people with details? It was true that I was excited for the wedding. I love Vanessa and Scott. Their wedding would be in New York, and I was thrilled that I would have the chance to visit my favorite city. But, and I cannot emphasize this enough, I would never, ever have offered to help Madeline with her event planning. That is just not something I do. In fact, I often go out of my way to avoid having to help with event planning. Why, I usually wonder to myself, would I want to help with tasks for which I will receive zero recognition or complimentary chocolate? No, not for me. But do you know who loves parties? Who adores planning? Whose passion for details and sensitivity to the needs of others is her entire raison d'être? Take a guess. Still Becca, obviously. Becca was a favorite at craft service. Ellie, are you ever in a bad mood? The chefs would ask, thinking they were talking to the real me and not the character who had taken over my body. I would smile and laugh and hand them another poem with stickers and cotton candy perfume all over it. Let's make today our best one yet, I would cry out. The crew adored me. Even my own family began to wonder what was happening. We love the American flag that you sewed us for Flag Day, my dad said carefully on the phone. How are you able to stitch such tiny smiley faces inside each star? My sunniness was irrepressible, and my zest for life knew no limits. One morning, I bounded into the hair and makeup trailer. Melissa McCarthy was sitting in the chair, and I could tell there was something different about her. You changed your hair, I said, pointing to her head. I love your hair. The real me would have given my fellow actor the silence and the focus that we all so earnestly need before a grueling day of work. I also rarely, if ever, notice anything different about anyone. However, hairstyles and other people would be two of Becca's keenest interests. Melissa laughed and told me it was just a wig. It's not your real hair? I asked. But I didn't stop there. I couldn't. Come on, you've got to be kidding me. I pulled Melissa's hair and the wig came right off. Oh, I believe it now, I said, turning then to sit in my own chair. Melissa's hairstylist glared at me and began to reposition the wig on Melissa's head. I smiled back, laughing. Does anyone mind if I put on the Cinderella soundtrack? Was this how Marlon Brando felt? I knew that I had to regain control of the situation, but I wasn't sure just how to do that. You won't be a bridesmaid forever, I tried to soothe myself. After Vanessa and Scott's wedding, you will simply be playing a character. But July 3rd came and went, and still I felt like Becca. Always a bridesmaid, I thought. I couldn't remember the rest of the saying in that moment, but I found the first part to be really, really true. I had not yet hit rock bottom, but I was so close I could smell the biotite. And then, one fateful Friday evening in Culver City, I rose again from ashes. In the movie, there is a scene in which all the bridesmaids, except beautiful Rose, get food poisoning. There is a lot of puking and diarrhea. It took time to get everything just right, and we filmed many takes. My own vomit mixture was a scrumptious blend of graham crackers, vanilla pudding, and whipped cream provided to me by the prop department. And let's just say I could have kept vomiting all night. That's how tasty it was. During a lighting setup change, I asked Wendy how her vomit mixture tasted. Wendy's character spent more time hunched over a toilet than any of us, and I figured this would be a stimulating topic for a chat. It's actually delicious, she told me, full of bananas, which I love. I started to reply and then stopped short. What did she just say? I thought to myself. Did Wendy just say she got bananas in her vomit mixture? Now, I love bananas. I eat one with breakfast nearly every morning. So why on earth did Wendy get to have all the fun? Wait a minute, I quickly realized. I knocked on my head. Who's there? I knew that Becca would never think such a jealous thought. I knew that she would take whatever vomit mixture was provided to her and smile. But do you know who does care about details like prop food? Do you know who would allow this omission of bananas to derail her day? Do you know who definitely gets competitive about who has the best snack? Take a guess. Me! It was me. I was back. Ellie. Listener, I had returned. The real Ellie was back. And the character of Becca existed fiercely, but only temporarily, between action and cut.
Goodbye, Becca, I whispered to myself during that night's drive home in the Fusion. That's a wrap on Becca, I went on. And then, like the real Ellie I was, I dared to dream a bit bigger. And the Oscar nomination goes to, I thought to myself with a smile. Not me.
Kristen Wiig and Annie Mumolo for Best Original Screenplay and Melissa McCarthy for Best Supporting Actress.
Slob.
Here are all the things my husband believes will kill you. Cell phones. Cordless phones. The sun on a sunny day. The sun on a cloudy day. The sun on a rainy day. Rain. Air conditioning to the point where it is comfortable. Anything that has touched the floor at any point in the past 30 years. Fumes from a bus. Fumes from a car. Fumes from a van. Fumes from a chimney. Fumes from a truck. Fumes from a motorboat. Various other fumes. All fruit that is not organic, except bananas. All vegetables that are not organic. Red meat. Cigarette smoke. Dead batteries. New York City tap water. My hands after I touch my cell phone. My hands after I eat non-organic fruit. My hands after I put poison on them. The microwave. Airplanes. Mosquitoes. A spot of water or a piece of dust. If either one has landed on his glasses. Here are all the things I believe will kill you. Cigarette smoke. I am sure that most of the things my husband believes will kill you will, in fact, eventually kill you. I started looking up some of these substances to determine their toxicity and then got too depressed to keep going. Lots of these items could make you sick, but most of them have to be experienced pretty extremely to have a harmful effect. Anyway, we can't live in a bubble of sterility. I can't stop eating dead batteries just because there is a slight risk to my life. I have to be who I am. Here is who I am. I am a woman who doesn't always wash her hands after going to the bathroom at home. Yes, that's sick. But how sick is it? I'm not touching anything but toilet paper when I go to the bathroom. I'm in my own home, so I have to assume the flush handle is clean enough. And I have really dry hands. Washing my hands aggravates this condition. For this reason, you can see why I try to avoid unnecessary hand washing. Once, my husband was a witness to this. He and I were both in the bathroom. He was brushing his teeth, and I was, as the professionals say, going pee-pee. I finished, flushed the toilet, and absent-mindedly turned on the sink faucet for my usual 5 seconds. Then I turned it off without running my hands under the water.
"You didn't wash your hands," he said, his mouth full of toothpaste.
"I know," I said. "They aren't dirty." My husband spat in the sink.
"You just went to the bathroom," he told me. "But my hands aren't dirty," I repeated, getting louder. "I have dry hands!"
Michael was speechless for a moment.
He was foaming at the mouth, and I had to remind myself that it was just toothpaste.
He took a deep breath and steadied himself against the vanity. "Why did you run the water?" he asked. "Were you planning to wash your hands and then you forgot?" His eyes looked hopeful. I looked down at the floor for a minute. Then I looked back up at him. "I didn't forget," I said quietly. "I was never going to wash them. I turn on the water so that anyone standing by the door thinks I'm washing my hands. That was the plan all along."
While I recognize that I'm gross, somewhere deep within me, I must also think I'm not that gross. I like the outdoors. I like dirt. I don't always wash fruit, I rarely shower after a plane ride, and I'll eat Cheez-Its off the floor up to 50 minutes after they fill. I used to brag about how rarely I get sick, and then I noticed that I actually get sick quite a bit. So maybe I should sanitize a bit more, but maybe not.
I had to assume, with my laid-back approach toward germs, that I would be pretty cool if I ever had a baby. When asked, and nobody ever asked me about this, I predicted that I would be the kind of relaxed mom you see at the coffee house, the one who gives her baby 100% of her attention, while also casually enjoying a latte with the elderly widow from her apartment co-op.
When our baby drops her bottle on the ground, this cool mom picks it up and gives it back to her. She doesn't run screaming to the barista for an antiseptic. She asks the old widow a little more about what it was like being a homemaker during World War II. She giggles a little bit, pulls out a mason jar of overnight oats from her reusable grocery tote, feeds both herself and her baby with the same spoon, and finally leaves the coffee house for the subway with comfort and ease. Because this mom understands that New York City transit germs are the very best germs in the world. There was just one problem with this vision, and it was one that I could not possibly have foreseen. The world is a disgusting place. How did this happen? Where had all these germs and danger been hiding? For the first 36 years of my life, I walked on this earth unafraid and alive. I shook people's hands during the Peace Be With You section of Mass. I pressed my face right up to the microwave to watch the meat defrost. Wildlife didn't scare me, and neither did a tall bathtub. Then, in July of my 36th year, I had a baby, and everything changed. Suddenly, floors were dirty. Sponges were deadly. A sneeze from across the apartment threatened my family's very existence. "Did you wash your hands?" I shriek, as Michael leans down to pick up our wailing newborn. "I think I did," he says, panicked. "Wait a minute. Did I?" He puts our 5-day-old baby back in the bassinet and races to the kitchen. I run after him and nearly knock him over trying to scrub my own paws. I'm so scared," I whisper to Michael. We hold each other close as our son, James, wails from his bassinet because he is hungry and his mom and dad are holding each other instead of feeding him. We don't give swaddling a minute's thought. "It's too risky," I say to Michael as we watch James sleep. "The blanket could creep up over his face," he agrees. "It feels like this trendy new trick." Earliest depictions of swaddled babies date back to the Paleolithic era. "And I'm just not convinced that it's a safe way to soothe the baby," I conclude. And we both fall asleep on the couch until James wakes up 18 minutes later. James has his very first visit to the pediatrician when he is only a week old. We are living in the West Village, and the doctor's office is less than a mile away. However, it is August, and we worry about the sun's rays. "I know it's only 8 a.m., I say to Michael as we pack James's bag like we were going on a months-long safari. "But it's the height of summer." Michael nods. "I don't like James being out in all that air," he says, inspecting a small spot on James's cheek. "What is this spot?" he cries. I lean in to look. "It was some dust," I say gravely. "James had some dust on his cheek." We stare at each other and shake our heads, but we know that it is time to figure out our route to Dr. Barney Softness, M.D. We don't trust a taxi driver, and there is no subway or bus route that wouldn't require a fair amount of walking. Instead, we decide to use a service called Kid Rides. These drivers will be both parents and drivers, I assume out loud. The Kid Rides car pulls up, and it is enormous. It is almost a bus, but it's not. I immediately ask the driver if she has any children. "Try 4, she says, smiling. I wink at her, knowingly. "Moms and their kids," my eyes say. She straps our car seat into the car as though she has done it 1,000 times before. And she probably has, both with her own kids and for her work at Kid Rides. "How old is he?" the driver asks. Michael starts to answer, but I cut him off. "She's talking about the baby," I murmur to him. "He's 6 days old," I answer. "6 days today," I specify. "How old are your kids?" I ask, trying to make her feel comfortable. "My kids are 11, 9, 5, and 2, she replies. I look at her registration on the back of the driver's seat, which says her name is Angie. "And every single one of them is sick," she says, laughing as she turns onto 7th Avenue. I freeze. I turn to Michael. "Her kids are sick," I whisper urgently. "Her kids are sick," he whispers urgently back to me. I immediately lower a window to let in some fresh air. Michael raises it back up again. "The fumes," he tells me. "The fumes from outside." "The germs," I hiss back. "The germs from inside." "Does this little man have a summer cold?" Angie asks, turning on some jazz. I try hard to smile. "He is just a week old," I tell her. "I don't know if you can even get a cold this early on in life." "All sorts of kids have summer colds this time of year," Angie continues. "Just before I picked you up, I had a set of twins in here." She slows down for a jaywalker. The Sniffle Twins, she tells me, laughing. No, their last name was Martin, I think, she clarifies.
Just then, James spits out his pacifier. In the millisecond it takes to turn my eyes from Angie in the rearview mirror,